Chapter 10, The Threefold Path, Ethics. No one who has read in the Pali scriptures the glowing descriptions of the life of the Buddha and his disciples can doubt that they were all supremely happy people. Their love, compassion, renunciation, happiness and contentment profoundly impressed all who came within the orbit of their influence. Kings and courtiers, prostitutes and virtuous widows, soldiers and scholars, farmers and artisans, all sat at the feet of the Buddha in order to learn the secret of that radiant happiness. It is no wonder that among the many epithets by which he is known is the title Sugata, the Happy One. But even during the lifetime of the Buddha, there were many people who did not relish a reward as abstract as the peace and blessedness of Nirvana, but craved a teaching that would show them how to satisfy their human desires and aspirations. The Buddha would encourage people who felt like this by pointing out that there were various heavens in which they could be reborn as a reward for virtuous deeds, such as feeding the poor, providing for the sick, digging wells, and planting shady trees under which travellers could rest. But he did not omit to warn them that these celestial realms were temporary abodes. When their stock of merit is exhausted, the inhabitants of these heavens are caught again in the ceaselessly revolving wheel of change, to be born once more in the human realm and live and suffer as before. Perhaps, the Buddha would point out, once one had experienced these vicissitudes a few times, one would become weary of transient happiness and resolve to win the lasting bliss of Nirvana. The Buddha's ethical system also envisages a series of hells in which those who have behaved unskillfully are reborn as a result of their unskillful actions. But the hells are as transitory as the heavens. When their misdeeds have been expiated, the inhabitants of hell are born once more in the human realm and have yet another opportunity to find the path that leads beyond the wheel of life. In the Buddhist vision, all beings, even the bird and the flower, some would say, will ultimately become enlightened. The law of karma. All this, of course, follows from the law of karma. In its simplest and most widely accepted form, the doctrine of karma is merely an expression of the universal belief that as we sow, so do we reap. Ultimately, we ourselves will feel the effects of our actions. The doctrine of karma helps in some degree to explain the apparent discrepancies of fortune that exist in the world, but one has to be very careful here. Someone's suffering or happiness is not necessarily the result of their past actions. The law of karma is often much misunderstood in this respect. Here we come back again to the basic truth, conditionality. The Buddha identified five orders of conditionality, five niyamas, as Buddha Ghosha subsequently called them. Physical inorganic, physical organic, i.e. biological, psychological, karmic, and transcendental. Unless one has the insight of a Buddha, one cannot be sure which niyamas have brought about what particular effect. The example usually given is that of a fever. If one gets a fever, it may be a chill caused by a sudden change in temperature, or one may have caught a viral infection, or perhaps one has succumbed to an illness as a result of some kind of mental strain, or it may have been caused by an unskillful action committed in the past, or it may even be the effect on one's system of transcendental insight. Thus the same end result may have been brought about by something physical, something biological, something psychological, something karmic, or something transcendental, or a combination of two or more of these. Causality is a complex web. Anything that happens or comes into being does so as a result not of one cause, but of many. Indeed, and this is an aspect of the Buddha's insight into reality, if one reflects on the factors that have produced the coming together of any phenomenon, there is simply no end to them. Consider, for example, what has caused the loaf of bread or the bag of rice in your kitchen. Think of the people involved and what caused them. Think of their ancestry stretching back into beginningless time. Think of the sun and the rain and the earth. Think of transportation and packaging materials. Really, there is nothing and no one who has not been involved in the coming into being and into your kitchen of that loaf of bread. This is, incidentally, another way of coming at the truth of Anatman, no separate selfhood. Reflection shows us that nothing has an own being separate from everything else. Everything and everyone is interconnected. To illustrate this, Mahayana Buddhism gives us the image of Indra's net, an infinite net of jewels, each of which reflects all the other jewels in the net. The many-stranded complexity of causality means that if someone is suffering in some way, it cannot be assumed that this is inevitably the result of unskillful behaviour on their part. It may be, but you just can't tell. Hinduism adopts a fatalistic view of the law of karma, and some Buddhists seem to say something similar. But the Buddhist doctrine of the five niyamas makes it clear that someone's present suffering cannot be assumed to imply past unskillfulness. What we can be sure of is that present unskillfulness is almost certain to result in future suffering, although some minor unskillful actions are cancelled out by skillful ones. And skillful action will bring us joy. Our locus classicus here is the very beginning of the Dhammapada. Unskillful mental states are preceded by mind, led by mind and made up of mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows him even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Skillful mental states are preceded by mind, led by mind, and made up of mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows him like his shadow. This is the basis of Buddhist ethics, sometimes summarized as actions have consequences. So here we have the law of conditionality as applied to the ethical sphere. The Buddhist tradition has many sets of precepts or training principles, the most universally practiced of which is the list of the five ethical precepts. They're not rules in any narrow literalistic sense. It is more accurate to describe them as principles of ethical behaviour. They reflect the way an enlightened person would naturally behave, so that in trying to behave in that way oneself, one moves gradually towards enlightenment. The five precepts. There are four basic precepts, together with a fifth, which is equally basic, but upon the practice of which not all Buddhists agree. This is the way they are expressed. I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking life. I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking the not given. I undertake the training principle of abstaining from sexual misconduct. I undertake the training principle of abstaining from false speech. I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking drink and drugs that cloud the mind. These five precepts enshrine, broadly speaking, the principles of non-violence, non-appropriation, chastity, truthfulness, and mindfulness. The principle of non-violence is that we should refrain from harming or hurting others, and in particular from killing or injuring them. Fundamentally, violence is the assertion of one's ego at the expense of another. In its most extreme form, it means the physical elimination of another in one's own personal interest. Violence towards another human being thus represents a denial of fundamental human solidarity, a radical assertion of separative selfhood, and a failure to identify imaginatively with another person. If you are capable of violence towards someone, it is because you are failing to put yourself in their position, to empathize with them, to feel their feeling as your own. To a violent person, another person is simply an object, a thing. Violence is thus the ultimate negation of ethical and spiritual life. And non-violence in some ways represents the fundamental principle of Buddhism. There is one text, in fact, the Mahavastu of the Lokottara Vardins, which says this, that non-violence is the supreme Dharma. The implication is that if you sincerely try to practice non-violence, you will find in the long run that you are practicing every other Buddhist virtue. In principle, they are all contained in non-violence. Non-violence means not just that we should abstain from acts of violence, but that we should work for the welfare and happiness of mankind by every means in our power. This it is impossible to do unless our hearts are full of love towards people. Non-violence, ahimsa, may be defined as love in action. If we want our actions to be harmless and helpful, we should at all times cultivate a loving state of mind. Without this, it is impossible to do any real good. A hateful thought can work untold harm in the world. All deeds of violence were once hateful thoughts, just as all acts of charity were once thoughts of love. Love is the only force strong enough to overcome hatred, and for this reason, it is the most powerful weapon in the world. Clearly, the practice of ahimsa on an international scale would entirely preclude the possibility of war or any other form of bloodshed or butchery, including capital punishment and the slaughter of animals for food. The ideal of ahimsa is that it should be universal in practice and universal in application. A clear statement of this is to be found in the Metta Sutta, or Discourse on Divine Love, which is expressive of the very essence of ahimsa. Now may every living thing, or weak or strong, omitting none, tall, middle-sized or short, subtle or gross of form, seen or unseen, those dwelling near or dwelling far away, born or unborn, may every living thing abound in bliss. Let none deceive or think scorn of another in whatever way. But as a mother watches o'er her child, her only child, so long as she doth breathe, so let him practice unto all that live an all-embracing mind. And let a man practice unbounded love for all the world, above, below, across, in every way, love unobstructed, void of enmity. Standing or moving, sitting, lying down, in whatsoever way that man may be, provided he be slothless, let him found firmly this mindfulness of boundless love, for this is what men call the state sublime. So shall a man, by leaving far behind all wrongful views, by walking righteously, attain to Gnostic vision and crush out all lust for sensual pleasures. Such in truth shall come to birth no more in any womb. The second great principle of Buddhist ethics is the principle of non-appropriation. Violence is based on a strong sense of I, and appropriation is based on a strong sense of mine, The two go together. So we must not take what belongs to others, either by force or by fraud. In other words, we must not steal. The traditional phrase is that we should not take the not given. This is obviously going to mean not appropriating things that belong to other people. And this includes acquiring debts that one is unable to repay and borrowing things without asking. But one can also take the not given in the sense of taking people's time or energy without checking with them that they are willing to give it. When it comes to the non-appropriation of material things, this includes the kind of thing that many people these days would hardly think of as theft at all. Living as we do in a world governed, even dominated by institutions and multinational corporations, it is easy to feel that cheating them, perhaps fiddling our tax return or claim for social welfare, or taking home stationery from the office, is ethically insignificant, even justifiable in the face of what we may perceive as an unjust system. This kind of attitude, though, fails to take into account the true nature of Buddhist ethics. Morality is not an end in itself. The altruistic aspect of ethical behaviour is obvious. What may not be so obvious is that our actions have their effects on us too. Each of the five precepts is expressed not just in negative terms. I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking the not given, for example, but also in positive terms. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. With open-handed generosity, I purify my body. With stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. With truthful communication, I purify my speech. With mindfulness, clear and radiant, I purify my mind. Here we are reminded that practicing these precepts involves the cultivation and expression of positive qualities, as well as abstention from doing harm. We are also reminded, through the emphasis on purification, that in behaving ethically we are refining and purifying our own mental states, and thus preparing the ground for the practice of meditation and the development of wisdom. Whether we feel that our appropriation of what belongs to the government or our employer is going to make any difference to them is, viewed from this perspective, neither here nor there. If our aim is to see things as they really are, an aspect of this is going to be the attempt to break down the barrier between self and other. The practice of ethics gives us constant opportunities to do this, to go beyond the strong sense we have of the separation between me and the world or other people. And of course, we're reminded all the time these days that even actions that seem so small as to make no difference can in fact have a devastating cumulative effect on wildlife, on weather systems, on the whole world. The third precept relates to the principle of chastity. This is obviously about our sexual behaviour, and it means in the first place that we should not exploit others sexually, should not obtain sexual satisfaction by means of force, fraud, or misrepresentation. Sex, as everybody knows, is a very powerful urge indeed. The Buddha once said something to the effect that if there was another samsaric force that was as strong, we would have no hope of spiritual development. If one takes one's practice of Buddhism seriously, therefore, one will naturally find oneself relegating sexual activity to the periphery of one's life, rather than allowing it to occupy a central position. And one's aim will be eventually to achieve complete chastity of body, speech, and mind, even though, to be realistic, for many people this may be possible only towards the end of life. But we can all aim to cultivate stillness, simplicity, and contentment in this area of life, aiming to be contented with our situation, whether we are married or single, homosexual or heterosexual, and whether we choose to be sexually active or not. The Buddha had no pronouncements to make about sexual orientation or behaviour. Nothing is singled out either for special approval or for condemnation. What is important is that we should bring a spirit of non-harming to our sexual activities, and that we should steer clear of the modern Western tendency to glorify the sexual relationship, a tendency that has manifestly caused a great deal of unhappiness. The fourth principle is that of truthfulness. We should never in any way, either directly or indirectly, give our consent or approval to what we know is false. Truthfulness in its widest sense may be defined as unity of thought, word and deed. In the Pali scriptures, the Buddha is often referred to not as the Buddha, but as the Tathagata. There are various explanations of the meaning of this title, but one of them is that a Tathagata is one who acts as he speaks and speaks as he acts. That this achievement constitutes almost a definition of enlightenment itself shows how rare a quality complete truthfulness really is. Without truthfulness, there can be no such thing as commerce, no such thing as the administration of justice, and no such thing as politics in the true sense of the term. It is interesting that in the Pali scriptures, when the Buddha refers to truthfulness, the illustration he chooses is from the judicial context. If a witness commits perjury, even after taking an oath, justice cannot be administered. And if justice cannot be administered, the whole social fabric collapses. The speaking of truth in the courtroom is an example, almost a paradigmatic example of truthfulness. Because unless the truth is held to be sacred in such a context, there's really no social human life. And one might add, untruthfulness consists not merely in telling lies, but also in refraining from speaking the truth, when this might remove ignorance and misunderstanding. In Swift's satire, Gulliver's Travels, when Gulliver visits the country of the Houyhnhnms, he discovers that they are so virtuous that they don't have a word for lie. Gulliver has to take great pains to explain what a lie is, and in response, the Houyhnhnms coin a term in their own language, to speak the thing that is not. So, we speak the thing that is not, we tell lies. But why? Untruthfulness is always based on negative mental states. We tell lies or suppress the truth, we exaggerate or minimize, either out of greed, to get something we couldn't otherwise get, or out of fear of punishment, or just out of vanity. In some very rare circumstances, one may need to give up truthfulness for the sake of a still greater virtue. The classic illustration given by the Buddhist tradition is that of a monk who saw a man running to hide himself behind some bushes. Presently, a band of ruffians with swords in their hands came dashing along the road in hot pursuit and asked the monk if he'd seen the man they were looking for. And of course, the monk said he had not. In such a case, one can be excused from telling the truth, since if one did so, one would incur responsibility for murder. But most of us are unlikely ever to be caught on the horns of such a dilemma. The alternatives between which we are forced to choose are usually to tell the truth and so lose something, or to tell a lie and so be enriched. In modern life, there are many occasions when one may be tempted to bend the truth, particularly, again, when dealing with tax forms or other official business. This is another area of ethics in which it is easy to feel that the institutions of the state or the multinationals, impersonal as they are, will not feel the effect of our actions. This may or may not be true, but we ourselves will feel the effects of unskillful behaviour. We need to bear in mind the alienating effect of untruthfulness on our own mental states. The fifth precept is, broadly speaking, the application of the principle of mindfulness. But, and this is why it is controversial in Buddhist circles. It is expressed in terms of abstention from drink and drugs that cloud the mind. And of course, the most common of these is alcohol. There is some difference of opinion among Buddhists, even in the East, regarding this precept. Some believe that a Buddhist should abstain from alcohol totally. Others would say that one can take alcohol in moderation, that is to say, to the extent that it does not cloud one's awareness. Personally, I think that it is better if, as Buddhists, we can abstain totally. Even if the occasional drink doesn't do us any harm, what about the example we set? One has only to open the newspapers to see how much harm, how much damage, how much misery, how much loss of life is caused by the abuse of alcohol. So I think that Buddhists really need to set an example here. Some years ago, one of my students, touring around some of the Buddhist centres in America, was shocked to find that some centres actually had their own bar, so that whether before or after meditation, you could just go and have a drink, a cocktail, or whatever. I think that, at the very least, alcohol should not be available at Buddhist centres or at Buddhist functions. But of course, there is more to this precept than the question of whether or not we drink alcohol, important though that question is. Mindfulness, one could say, is the characteristic virtue of the thinking or mental part of our makeup. It goes far beyond such practices as doing the washing up mindfully, answering the telephone with awareness, and so on, although all such practices are valuable. Mindfulness means, above all, that every day of the week, every hour of the day, and every minute of the hour, we continually bear in mind the true nature of our situation. We need, in other words, to bear in mind the Four Noble Truths: suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. We have seen in the chapter on the gravitational pull that virtuous behaviour alone cannot take us to enlightenment. This is symbolised not just by the second circle of the wheel of life, with its light and dark halves, but also by the third circle, with its depiction of the six realms. Skillful action will result in pleasant consequences for us, symbolised by the realm of the gods, and unskillful action will have unpleasant consequences, symbolised by the hell realm. But in the Buddhist vision, both heaven and hell are still within the round of mundane existence, within the conditioned. Once we have experienced the karmic consequences of our actions, we will still be faced with the necessity of finding the way beyond the wheel of life. This is why ethics or morality is only the first stage of the threefold path. At the same time, this idea that mindfulness can extend to mindfulness of our purpose in life, indeed, that this is a crucial aspect of the practice of mindfulness, suggests that practicing ethics fully is going to take us on to the further stages of the path. In practice, skillful behaviour, as conceived by the Buddha, only makes sense in the context of a commitment to the spiritual path. There is no God in Buddhism insisting on our following a list of commandments because he says so. Ethics is conceived not as an end in itself, but as a means to the attainment of enlightenment. The Three Refuges. This connection between skillful behaviour and commitment to the path to enlightenment is made explicit in a practice that is followed by Buddhists of all schools, the recitation of the refuges and precepts. The three refuges are the three jewels of Buddhism: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The recitation of the refuges is an expression of one's commitment to the three jewels, traditionally called going for refuge to the three jewels. And then, straight after reciting these verses of commitment to the spiritual path, one chants or recites the five precepts. It is in the context of going for refuge, in other words, that ethical practice is most meaningful. I want therefore to go into this question of going for refuge to the Three Jewels in a bit more detail. It presents us with another way of regarding the path to enlightenment. Indeed, I would say that it presents us with the most important, or at least the most fundamental way of regarding that path. Going for refuge to the Three Jewels, one could say, is the fundamental act of the Buddhist's spiritual life. Of course, to make sense of this, one needs to understand what the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha really are. For example, a Buddhist is one who goes for refuge to the Buddha as the Buddha. He or she has faith in the Buddha as the enlightened one, not something else. This may seem obvious, but it isn't to everyone. If, for example, one spends any time in India, one is sure to meet with Hindus, pious, religious-minded Hindus. And if in such company one mentions the name of the Buddha, they say, "Oh yes, we know all about him. He's the ninth incarnation of the Hindu god Vishnu." As a Buddhist, one has to disagree with this view of the Buddha. When I lived in India, myself, I frequently found myself having to say, "No, the Buddha was not an incarnation of a god. He was a human being who gained enlightenment by his own efforts." Similarly, we don't go for refuge to the Buddha if we consider him to have been just a wise man like Socrates, or just an ethical teacher like Epictetus. If we have that sort of idea about the Buddha, if we have any idea about him other than that he's an enlightened one, there's no going for refuge. Similarly, there's no refuge if one simply admires the Buddha's personality from a safe distance, saying, "Oh, how wonderful! The Buddha was so kind, so compassionate, so wise," while not allowing oneself actually to be moved by his enlightened qualities. No amount of simple admiration constitutes going for refuge. In the same way, one has to understand what is really meant by Dharma in order to go for refuge to the Dharma. The Dharma is the transcendental path to enlightenment. If one regards it just as a source of interesting and useful ideas, or of merely academic interest, then even if one knows quite a lot about it, especially in its historical manifestations, one is not going for refuge to the Dharma. One is not actually a Buddhist. Academic knowledge about Buddhism certainly has its own definite, though limited, value, but going for refuge to the Dharma is quite another matter. Going for refuge to the Sangha means going for refuge to the Arya Sangha, those men and women who have personally realized the higher stages of the transcendental path, stream entry and beyond. Sometimes it's said that one goes for refuge to the Bhikkhu Sangha, to the order of monks, but this is not at all correct. The Sangha to which one goes for refuge consists of both monks and lay people. Indeed, on this level, the distinction between monastic and lay doesn't have much relevance. By the way, I'm quite deliberately using the expression going for refuge, not taking refuge. Many Western Buddhists talk of taking refuge with Bhikkhu so-and-so or Laman so-and-so, but the original expression is definitely "I go, gacchami." This is quite an important difference, I think. The implication is that going for refuge is an action, something one does. It's a movement towards something infinitely greater than oneself. One can even speak of going for refuge as a surrender of oneself. But taking refuge has a rather different connotation. It suggests appropriation. It suggests trying to make the Three Jewels yours in an egoistic sense, even trying to grab them, rather than trying to make yourself theirs. It may seem like quibbling to insist on saying going for refuge rather than taking refuge, but the use of the latter expression may be symptomatic of an unhealthy trend in contemporary Buddhism. Nowadays we are presented with marvellous opportunities for understanding and practicing many different forms of Buddhism. Things were very different when I came into contact with Buddhism more than 50 years ago. At that time, there was only one Buddhist group in London, and it was probably the only one in Britain. and it had perhaps a dozen active members. I can remember us meeting during the war in a little room in central London, not far from the British Museum. On one occasion we were sitting there meditating. Well, at least we were sitting there with our eyes closed, trying to experience some inner peace. And suddenly there was a terrific noise and the windows rattled. Of course a bomb had fallen. But I'm glad to say that nobody moved. Whether this was Buddhist equanimity or British phlegm, I'm not sure. Perhaps we were all waiting for somebody else to move first, but nobody moved. We just sat there and finished our meditation. That was Buddhism in Britain 50 years ago. Things are very different these days. There are at least a couple of dozen flourishing Buddhist groups just in London, and hundreds more throughout Britain. While in America there are probably several thousand groups, representing nearly all the Eastern Buddhist traditions. These have all come to the West, at least as addressed to Westerners. I'm not referring here to the so-called ethnic Buddhist communities. Within the last 20 or 30 years, in what amounts to a tremendous radical cultural development. Before this happened, our knowledge of religion was pretty well limited to Christianity. Perhaps we'd just about heard of Islam if we'd read about the Crusades. But now, well, not to speak just of Buddhism, we know, or at least we've heard of so many different religions. There's been this vast expansion in our spiritual horizon. But there's a danger of what could perhaps be called pseudo-spiritual consumerism. Nowadays we're consumers almost by definition. I shop, therefore I am, just about sums up our philosophy. And there's a danger that we will bring this consumerist attitude with us when we approach Buddhism, especially when it is presented to us in so many tempting varieties, in so many mysterious, exotic and fascinating forms. Only too often, I'm afraid, we just can't wait to get our sticky little paws on them. There's a sort of smorgasbord of spiritual goodies just waiting to be devoured, and the temptation is to pick and choose as the fancy takes us. If we do this, we become not Buddhists, not people who go for refuge, but consumers of Buddhism. And to be a consumer of Buddhism is the very antithesis of the transformation that Buddhism is all about. As consumers, we assimilate Buddhism to ourselves, at least in its externals, assimilate it to our own greed, hatred, and delusion. But if we are to transform ourselves, we need to assimilate ourselves to Buddhism. This commitment to transformation is a progressive thing. In the process of a deepening commitment, a deepening going for refuge to the three jewels, it is possible to identify a number of levels, and I have come up with my own terms for these, to paraphrase the equivalents in Pali and Sanskrit. Levels of going for refuge. The first level is what I would call cultural going for refuge, or even ethnic going for refuge. In the Buddhist East, there are tens, scores, perhaps even hundreds of millions of Buddhists, and in a sense, they all go for refuge. At least they all repeat, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go, either in Sanskrit or Pali, or in their own language. So they all consider themselves to be Buddhists. But usually they repeat the refuge-going formula without attaching any great significance to it. It's just a formality. I have seen this myself many times. In the East, at the start of any Buddhist meeting, someone, usually a monk, recites or chants the three refuges and five precepts, and everybody repeats them after him. But rarely do people ask themselves, what are we doing? What does this mean? It's just a part of their culture, something they always do. It's the respectable thing to do, even. It's respectable to be a Buddhist and recite the refuges and precepts from time to time. But not much thought is given to it. It's something that you've inherited, something you do because your parents do or did, or because your grandparents do or did. This is cultural or ethnic going for refuge. Its significance is not really spiritual, but mainly cultural or even sociological. This is the first and lowest level of going for refuge. And of course, one need not depreciate that level. It's a start, a starting point. The next level is that of provisional going for refuge. This is the level of someone who is genuinely interested in Buddhism, but only up to a point. They may try to observe the precepts, sometimes. They may meditate a little, or even quite a lot, sometimes. They may read books on Buddhism, even take a degree in Buddhist studies. Many Western people who would describe themselves as Buddhists go for refuge on this sort of level. At this point, they are not making a serious effort to develop insight into the truth, nor are they really orientating their lives towards the three jewels. In fact, on the contrary, they may well be trying to fit Buddhism into a quite ordinary, probably quite affluent, probably middle-class lifestyle. This is provisional going for refuge up to a point. Then comes effective going for refuge. When your going for refuge is effective, you have given some thought to the matter. You know what is meant by the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and you really and truly wish with your whole heart, your whole soul, to go for refuge. You wish to practice the Dharma, to follow in the Buddha's footsteps, to be an effective member of the Sangha, to develop spiritually, even to gain enlightenment. And you are determined, at least in your conscious mind, that you will do that. You commit yourself to the three jewels. You haven't as yet had any major spiritual experience, any transcendental breakthrough, but you're doing your best to be a real, authentic practicing Buddhist of this tradition or that. This effective going for refuge is the level of going for refuge of the majority of sincere practicing Buddhists. Even in the Buddha's day, there were many, many of his disciples who achieved only this level of going for refuge, and it is illustrated many times in the Pali scriptures. Someone hears the Buddha teach, they are greatly impressed, and they accept the teaching sincerely, but they do not actually see reality. Nonetheless, they go for refuge, saying, "To the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go." And this is effective going for refuge. One has a theoretical understanding of the teaching. One tries to behave ethically. One practices meditation. And one does one's utmost to develop penetrative insight or clear vision. One does one's best to organize one's life in such a way as to make such things, especially meditation and the development of insight, possible. In short, one orients the whole of one's existence, as far as one possibly can, towards the three jewels. One gives Buddhism absolute priority in one's life. One is then effectively going for refuge. And then there's what I've come to call real going for refuge, which is synonymous in traditional Buddhist terms with stream entry, and also with what is called in the Buddhist texts the opening of the Dharma eye. Real going for refuge means that your faith in the three jewels has become unshakable. The traditional phrase is that no Shramana, no Brahmana, not even Brahma himself together with Mara the evil one, could shake your faith in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. It is absolutely unshakable, like the Himalayas themselves. And your ethical practice is also firmly established. Moreover, in that real going for refuge, there is a distinct, unmistakable element of what is called vipassana, or clear vision, which means a vision of the transcendental, not as something distant, but as something that is present here and now, actually realized, at least to some extent. Vipassana represents a sort of entry into, an approach to, the unconditioned itself. Again, there are a number of episodes in the Pali Buddhist scriptures that illustrate this level of going for refuge. The Buddha wandered around India for many years, going on foot from village to village, town to town, city to city, sometimes travelling through vast tracts of jungle. And in his wanderings he came across all sorts of people. He might meet a wandering ascetic, or a learned Brahmin, or a poor outcast, or a prince. Whoever they were, more often than not he would get into conversation with them and start telling them about the Dharma. Usually he took a gradual approach. He would start off by talking about the benefits of generosity, then about ethics, then about meditation. Only then, when the ground was thoroughly prepared, would he start speaking about his own specific teaching, conditionality, whether in the form of the Four Noble Truths or in some other form. The person, whether ascetic or Brahmin or outcast or prince, listened, and sometimes it happened that he or she was absolutely overwhelmed. And this experience found expression in what became a sort of stock phrase, indeed a phrase that's become common to the point of cliché in our own time. People said that they felt as though they had seen the light. It was as though they'd been living in darkness before, but now light had arisen and was shining on them. Another common way of putting it was that one felt as though one had been relieved of a great burden, a great weight. Nowadays, perhaps we describe this as the weight of anxiety, the anxiety that seems to pervade modern life. This person's Dharma eye would open. He or she would see reality, see the truth of conditionality, see that the whole of mundane existence is painful, at least potentially, transitory, and devoid of permanent, unchanging selfhood. As a result of this insight, the man or woman to whom the Buddha had spoken would be utterly transformed. And then from the depth of their heart would come these words, "Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. To the Buddha for refuge I go. To the Dharma for refuge I go. To the Sangha for refuge I go." This is the real going for refuge, the going for refuge that is consequent upon the opening of the Dharma eye. It's sometimes called transcendental going for refuge, because it's the going for refuge of stream entrance and others on the higher, purely transcendental part of the spiral path. But it is certainly a level to which all Buddhists may realistically aspire. Going for refuge is the central and definitive act of the Buddhist life. It is often quite neglected in some Buddhist circles, but in more recent times there seems to have been a revival of interest in it, as serious practitioners have looked more deeply into the teachings of their traditions. Followers of the iconoclastic Zen tradition, for example, have discovered that the great Zen teacher Dogen's faith revolved around going for refuge pure and simple. As he was dying, apparently, the last practice Dogen did was to walk around a pillar upon which he had written Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And he said, "In the beginning, in the middle, and in the end, in your life as you approach death, always through all births and deaths, always take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha." The refuges and precepts. Wherever you hear the three refuges chanted, they will always be followed by a recitation of the usually five precepts. One can say that if going for refuge or commitment to the three jewels is one's lifeblood as a Buddhist, observance of the precepts represents the circulation of that blood through one's whole body. So the precepts are the expression of one's going for refuge. Not only that, they also support it, because one cannot truly go for refuge while leading a thoroughly unethical life. Of course, the precepts are a basic Buddhist practice. Once one has been a Buddhist for some time, It is perhaps easy to find oneself thinking that there is no need to spend much time considering them. One may perhaps think that one knows them pretty well already. If one does think this, then one has probably not given them any serious thought at all, and it may well be time to start making a practice of them. It is easy to be distracted by the showier aspects of the Buddhist tradition, to be fascinated by Buddhist art and the mystery and glamour of the Tantra, or to be drawn into trying to disentangle beautiful knotty conundrums of Buddhist philosophy. It is also easy to forget basic things like the ethical precepts, which we do at our peril. When I received tantric initiations myself, I was told that initiation is a very secret, very sacred thing. It's not to be talked about. In fact, one of my Tibetan Lama teachers told me that I was permitted to speak about a particular initiation I had received only with one other person, whom he named. That was how secret it was in those days. But nowadays in the West, tantric initiation, even Anuttara Yoga Tantra, the highest yoga tantra, is being advertised. One enrolls for a weekend course, one pays one's fee, and one gets initiated, perhaps along with several hundred other people. One doesn't have to prepare oneself. One doesn't even have to be a Buddhist. This is certainly not in accordance with the Buddhist Vajrayana tradition. I remember one of my teachers telling me that if one wanted to practice Anuttara Yoga Tantra, one first of all had to practice the Hinayana. This was the term he used. Nowadays we usually say Theravada. For 12 years. One then practiced the Mahayana for 6 years. Then one practiced the Outer Tantra for 6 years. And only then would one be considered ready to receive Anuttara Yoga Tantra initiation. But nowadays it seems one can do it all in the course of a weekend. Of course, some teachers will justify this by saying that they are planting seeds that will mature in future. But I must say that I personally reject this explanation as a shameful rationalisation. If one really wants to plant seeds, one should teach Buddhist ethics.